Chief Justice Patience Rogenczak presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Okay, we have a number of people who want to speak on the rules petition 1913 that we're going to be hearing this morning. And in order to accommodate everybody, I would ask that if you've submitted a written material to the court, please don't repeat it or read it, but tell us something that you haven't had a chance to say because we've read what has been submitted. I will give the presenter, Robert Brooks, 20 minutes. After that, I plan to limit each speaker to 7 minutes. So it's not going to be a lot of time, but then I want to be able to hear what everyone has to say. So we will now begin, and Mr. Brooks, will you please proceed?
Thank you, and good morning. May it please the court, my name is Representative Robert Brooks. So during this last legislative session, I served as the co-chair of the study committee on child support. The committee was tasked with reviewing current standards and for determining physical placement and child support obligations. It's important to note the committee was co-chaired by Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee. Was comprised of 5 legislators, 8 public members, including a judge, court commissioner, private family attorney, domestic violence advocates, father right advocates, and child support agency directors. The diverse membership of the committee allowed us to hear from multiple stakeholders. It was important for us to receive feedback from both practitioners and those parents who would be directly impacted by policy change, both of which were represented on the committee. The committee proposed 11 bills, which are currently making their way through the legislative process, and I'm hopeful will all pass. One of the reoccurring topics during the committee's work was guardian ad litem. There was a consensus, an overall consensus, that GALs are currently overworked, underpaid, and need further understanding and training on numerous issues that directly impact the placement of children. The committee had a deeper appreciation for the integral role that GALs play in the process, and I think that these are the issues that the legislature needs to address in the future. I think it was important throughout the process, as we looked at the GAL issue, that we really, all of the issues we looked at, including the 11 bills we passed, GALs play a critical role. And as a legislator, I think it's important to note that so many of the systemic issues that we deal with, whether it's education, foster care, corrections, have such a direct impact into a child's formative years, you know, the GALs play a huge, huge role in the evaluation and recommendation in that process. And I think as a legislator and the courts that maybe we've been neglectful when it comes to GALs and really understanding the role they play in the process and making sure that we create the best environment for our children. Now, I understand, as a legislator, that we have limited resources, but I think it's important to note that we need to focus on this because that early investment in GAL's training and the best outcomes for children, I think will have a long systemic return on our investment. Again, GALs play that critical role. Our committee was very cognizant of that. You know, I am not an expert in this area. I'm a legislator, a citizen legislator. So, you know, it was different to have so many of the different partners involved in the process that brought so much to the table, you know, that brought life experiences and talked about the GAL's role. You know, I'm not saying that adding a little more training specific to domestic abuse is the answer, but I will say that I think it, out of all the issues we looked at, whether it was additional opiate training or other things, they all seem to tie back to sometimes domestic abuse and the trauma that that involves. So whether you adopt this policy specific to additional training for domestic abuse, I do hope that you look at additional training for GAL and know that the legislature will support additional funding at some point for this because we understand the critical role. So at this point, I'm going to bring up one of those experts to help me with testimony. We also have a Ledge Council here today that chair the committee, and they can provide other technical data. But now I'd like to introduce Maureen Atwell, who served on the committee. Maureen is the former director of Waukesha County Child Support Division, and she'll speak on behalf of some of the petitions that we came up with.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, I am Maureen Atwell, and as Representative a member on the committee, I am also a former domestic violence prosecutor and have worked in the field of family law and child support for many years. So I am here to represent the committee and help the court understand how the committee and why the committee reached this recommendation for the petition, and I can give you some of the background into why we felt this was important. The committee felt that it was important to amend the rule to require that a guardian ad litem in a family court action obtain... excuse me.
Our microphones are really goofy, so it's not you, but you have to be careful to speak sort of right into the middle.
Thank you. Please let me know if you can't hear me or if I'm echoing or being too noisy. I apologize. The committee felt that it was appropriate to make the recommendation of the three initial of the six credits for initial qualification for guardian ad litem requirements and one out of six credits for subsequent qualifications. The committee felt that this was at least a good start. I will say that the makeup of the committee included a family court judge and a family court commissioner, as well as some family court practitioners and two child support directors. Background of those who were making the decision as to whether this was a good recommendation or not is very well informed in terms of practice. The committee also heard from and was very much swayed by the testimony of family court consultants, counselors, and mediators. We did hear from Amber Peterson, a legal advisor for the Office of Court Operations, and I know that the court already, but I do want to bring it up because it did have an impact on our decision, and this is how we reached our decision. Under the state statutes, particularly under 767.407, a guardian ad litem shall investigate and report to the court evidence of domestic abuse. When the committee was hearing testimony as to why it was important for guardian ad litems to have education in domestic violence, looking at that statute and understanding that it is the guardian ad litem's role to investigate domestic violence and be able to inform the court is one of the reasons why the committee felt that this was very important. Domestic violence within a family impacts the court's decisions on custody and placement, obviously, but also on a number of peripheral issues under statute, such as how the child will be transferred between parents for the purposes of visitation, whether one party's address or employment location will be revealed to the other, whether the parties will be able to cooperate in decision-making in the future. There are such a large number of decisions that the court needs to make that are influenced or informed by whether or not there is domestic abuse in the relationship. The court, in certain circumstances, under 76741, the court must determine a primary aggressor in situations where both parties have committed domestic abuse. So in looking at all of these factors and weighing how important it is that the court understand and be informed as to whether there is domestic violence in the relationship, the role of the guardian ad litem is one of making a recommendation to the court. And the courts rely on guardian ad litems to be able to look into the details of the relationship and determine what is best for the child.
Counsel, you know, I did a lot of guardian ad litem work in my prior life. And I believed then, and I continue to believe, that the judge is the decision maker. And the role of the guardian ad litem, although the guardian ad litem can give a recommendation and most judges prefer that, it is the guardian ad litem's obligation to bring evidence to be presented to the judge so the judge will decide all of the things that you're talking about here that the statutes require. So I don't think that we should expect guardian ad litems to have a level of knowledge that makes them the final decision maker. The judge is the final decision maker, and sometimes I think guardian ad litem simply give a recommendation without presenting evidence, which puts the court in the position of not having really a factual evidentiary basis for the court's decision. So it's a concern of mine, at least, and I don't know about my colleagues, I'm sure they will talk with you about this too, that we not make the guardian ad litem a minor judge, but rather someone who advocates for the best interests of the child by presenting evidence to the court for the court to review and make a final decision on.
And I completely, absolutely agree with you. I think that for the guardian ad litem to be able to gather the evidence and present it to the court, having a background and having the education as to what domestic violence is all about, to understand how to recognize it. Domestic violence is often very complicated, and it's not always what it seems. So I think that the committee's feeling was that guardian ad litems have to have a better education to understand domestic violence would assist them in gathering the evidence in order to give it to the court to assist the court in making the decision, not to make the decision for the court or to, I absolutely agree with you that there are situations or there's maybe a tendency to think of a guardian ad litem as maybe a preliminary decision maker or a mini decision maker, but the guardian ad litem's role is really to gather the evidence so that this type of thing is not happening in front of the court and in open court. It's really somebody who's able to go into the home and talk to the child and do a really in-depth investigation to best give the evidence to the court. And understanding and having an education in domestic violence will assist guardian ad litems in gathering that evidence and giving it to the court so that the court itself can make the best decision.
So right now, Ms. Atwell, there's no requirement at all that guardian ad litems be educated in domestic violence topics. It's one of the options, but you could have guardian ad litems going into homes who have not had any education about domestic violence.
That is correct.
Okay. So when they're faced with it, they may not recognize it. Is that the concern?
Exactly. I think that people who have worked in the field of domestic violence or who have had domestic violence education understand that domestic violence is a very intricate and very complicated issue. And oftentimes, I think I mentioned before, that it's not always what it looks like on the surface. And there are a lot of misconceptions and misperceptions about domestic violence. So to have the education is so incredibly valuable. And that is one of the reasons why I personally am speaking to the court, not just as a representative of the committee because I participated in this decision, but also because my background is in domestic violence and in family court. And I've seen firsthand that domestic violence can be a very difficult issue to understand. So to have somebody going into the home with no background and no understanding as to what is involved in domestic violence, I think, is really a disservice to the court, who is relying on the guardian ad litem to give them information and to give them evidence so that they can make the best decision.
Yeah, I think the guardian ad litem needs to do more than, when I say present evidence, needs to do more than say, well, I went and I saw the family, I visited the children, I talked to the children. Those are all valuable things. But I suggest to you that everything shouldn't be presented to the court, screened through the guardian ad litem.
I would agree with you with that as well. And I think that in making the recommendation to the court, having the educational background in domestic violence will help the guardian ad litem not only say, you know, here's what I saw, but this is what I recommend based on what I understand about domestic violence, about the facts that I gathered, and really
to
be
presenting an expert witness. If you're going to make domestic violence a big part of recommendations to the court, don't you think that the guardian ad litem, who isn't an expert in domestic violence, should perhaps present the testimony of someone who is, so the court will have an understanding of how to evaluate what is being presented as a domestic violence concern for the family?
Can I clarify? Are you asking should a guardian ad litem, if the guardian ad litem suspects domestic violence, should the guardian ad litem recommend that an expert witness testify in the case?
If the guardian ad litem is going to talk about the effects of domestic violence in the family the guardian ad litem is assigned to for the children, I think that there's a danger with having the guardian ad litem be the expert as well as the lawyer for the children. I mean, well, you're really not the lawyer for the children because you're not adversary counsel. You're to present information to the court so the court can decide what is in the best interest of the child or children that are at issue here. And I have a bit of concern with what you're saying, because to me it sounds like the guardian ad litem goes into the home, looks and sees and has had some training in domestic violence and determines there's domestic violence in this home and that's going to greatly affect how this family proceeds. I don't know that guardian ad litems really are, I don't know that they have the professional expertise to explain to the court what the kind of occurrences that they've seen or heard about and are labeling as domestic violence actually will affect the family. That's what's bothering me.
I guess that your concern, perhaps if I can paraphrase, is that a little bit of education is a dangerous thing, and that are you concerned that a guardian ad litem having some education in domestic violence might make the guardian ad litem perhaps label themselves as an expert with only a small amount of education?
Yeah, that's kind of what's bothering me. And it probably varies from situation to situation, too. But I think if it's going to be an overriding concern that the guardian ad litem has and the guardian ad litem thinks the court needs to know about, the guardian ad litem can develop the facts. But I do think the guardian ad litem at that point probably should have someone come in that can, with foundation, speak to the effect on the family of these kinds of occurrences.
I would add two pieces of information to that. Perhaps, if the court will allow, perhaps my personal opinion is that, first, is that currently guardian ad litems are involved in these investigations and are making recommendations to the court with no expertise and no education. Mm-hmm. And so the chances of a guardian ad litem with no education in domestic violence assuming, making erroneous assumptions, so currently going into the home or going into the relationship and with no education about domestic violence, saying, I think that's domestic violence, and being wrong about it, or saying, I don't think that's domestic violence, and being wrong about it. Whereas with having some education in domestic violence, I think can only assist the guardian ad litems in making a better identification and making a better recommendation, more informed. I do think that your concerns are very legitimate, that with a small amount of education, it can label a person to be an expert when in fact they're not an expert at all. They simply have a small amount of education. And I, excuse me, I can.
It's not your fault. It's the mic.
I can appreciate those concerns, but I also think that the difference between having no education and having some education helps a great deal in helping the guardian ad litem to correctly identify domestic violence or lack of domestic violence. I also think that in the best case scenario, if the guardian ad litem said, I think there's domestic violence here, or if the guardian ad litem said, I don't see any domestic violence here, and one of the parties says there's domestic violence, I think that in the best case scenario, everybody would have available to them an expert witness, and every court would have the time to hear an expert witness and the resources to hear from an expert witness. But I think that a great deal of the parties being represented are coming through family court are unrepresented, and of low income. And so their ability to have an expert witness who can testify, I don't think that there's resources available in every case for that. And so at minimum, having a guardian ad litem, the question is, will we have a guardian ad litem with no education in domestic violence, or will we have a guardian ad litem with some education in domestic violence? If I had my preference, I would say that there should be a lot of education in domestic violence, but I also understand the limitations on not wanting to discourage people from being a guardian ad litem and wanting to make it available, because there is a shortage of guardian ad litems, and it is important that people are not discouraged. So I see the 3-credit requirement as something that's feasible without creating a burden on the courts, the court system, and particularly unrepresented or low-income litigants in having somebody who's a little bit better educated and who can speak to the issues, as opposed to somebody who doesn't have education about the issues.
Okay, thank you.
I'm trying to step back to when I did family law cases, and my recollection was when there was a dispute regarding custody or placement issues, a couple of things would happen. A guardian ad litem would be appointed, but also the Department of Social Services in our county would do a legal custody and placement study, go into the home, check out the home, interview people, also make recommendations to the court. I see your red light is on, so I'll wrap it up. But, you know, the court gets competing information sometimes. Sometimes it gets consistent information, but at the end of the day, it's the judge's determination that has to be made. Do the Department of Social Services people who perform the other kinds of recommendations to the court receive this kind of training? And why is the training limited to 767 cases?
I don't want to go over my time limit, so please feel free to...
You please answer Justice
Thank
Keeler's
you. Please
question.
Feel free to stop me at any point.
We want information in order
Thank
to
you.
Make our decisions informed.
Thank you. I do not know whether every county has social services involved in situations where custody and placement is in dispute. My experience in Milwaukee and Waukesha County was no. There was not, social services was not involved in custody and placement disputes. The court could appoint family court services, but it was not done all the time. And I think particularly in a large county like Milwaukee County, that was not the case. I unfortunately cannot speak to the educational requirements for the social services practitioners. I apologize.
Okay.
Are there any other questions for me?
Chief Justice, are we limited by the
yes,
red
you,
light?
Yes, no, you go right ahead,
All
please.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. I think you've touched on something that is extraordinarily important, but as I look at the role of the GAL, it's really broad and far-ranging.
It's what? I didn't hear that.
They are to consider matters of paternity, legal custody, physical placement, support. They're supposed to look at earning plans. They're supposed to consider the factors under 767.41 sub 5 a.m. And I look at that, 767.41 5 a.m. has 16 different provisions that a GAL is supposed to consider in matters of placement and custody. And as I read through them, that sounds like the description of a child psychologist. I mean, it is intense. And so so without discounting the importance of understanding matters of domestic abuse and violence, if we mandated a specific amount of CLE for that, shouldn't we also be considering mandating a certain level of CLEs for a GAL to essentially function as a child psychologist?
My my experience with family court and with domestic violence is that domestic violence is the one pervasive issue that often affects every single one of those points. And when the committee, I think Representative Brooks mentioned that when the committee looked at guardian ad litem education, we looked at what is realistic to expect and what is of top importance. And obviously, we had concerns about guardian ad litem's understanding alcohol and substance abuse issues, understanding financial issues, understanding how all of these different factors that are listed in the statutes impact the child. But in the end, the testimony that we received about issues of domestic violence and how pervasive they are in family court cases and how they impact all of the factors and how strongly they impact the well-being of the child, the committee determined that that was of the utmost importance. Whether or not the court should address whether other educational requirements should be appropriate for guardian ad litems, I think may be a question for the court. I think that this was the committee's feeling that this was a good start, that we may not resolve all of the challenges that face guardian ad litems. We may not resolve all of the challenges that face the courts, but to at least give a minimal amount of education on the one issue that has the greatest impact was the reason why the committee chose this particular issue.
And would the idea be to have the CLEs focus on domestic abuse as discussed in the domestic abuse guidebook for Wisconsin guardians ad litem, or instead the definition of domestic abuse contained in our statutes?
So historically, the court has left the scope of CLEs up to the individual practitioner and has given a tremendous amount of freedom to practitioners to seek out the type of CLE that the practitioner feels that they need, with the exception of the ethics credit. Or the ethics requirement, which the court, I think, took a look at and said, you know, the ethics requirement is of heightened importance. So I think for this court to say simply domestic violence education. So the committee is not asking that the court specify a particular topic for the education, because I think each practitioner should be able to seek out that education based on what the practitioner's needs are, as well as the education that's available to that practitioner. And the committee did hear testimony that domestic violence education is widely available. It's widely available in our state. It's available via the internet.
If we're interested in mandating this, shouldn't we be mandating CLEs that are tied to the statutory considerations that GALs are supposed to consider?
I think that that would be up to the court if the court wished to take that step. I do think, though, I guess as a matter of opinion, my experience is that there are such a broad range of topics regarding domestic violence that could and would be very, very useful in helping educate guardian ad litems to make the right decisions, and for the court to try to label those educational opportunities as specifically this is what it should look like, I think would exclude some really important education. I think it would be really hard for the court to outline very specifically this is what the credits should look like.
Yeah, the reason I ask is Professor Viney has expressed some concern that there is, in this domestic abuse guidebook, such a blurring of the discussion of what constitutes domestic abuse there, such a blurring of that with the statutes that it really wouldn't help GALs understand what domestic abuse is in Wisconsin courts. And that's kind of the idea behind this, right? We want GALs to provide useful information to the court about what domestic abuse is under the law, right?
And I would argue that a GAL having no education is less likely to be able to inform the court correctly than a GAL with some education. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Brooks, do you have other people that you wanted to
have speak with us as part of your presentation as a presenter?
No, I think Ms. Atwell did a great job, but I do want to address as part of the presentation here, and other people will get into the details more. Chief Justice, you brought up an excellent point, and that is, where is the guardian ad litem's role in this process? And it is something that we weighed heavily on, and that is, again, to make an evaluation and a recommendation. An evaluation and recommendation. Not to make a decision, not to be an expert, not to be a final arbiter, but to identify those things. And when we look at the 11 other bills that we introduced, some of those were to look at how do we empower our commissioners and judges with that information. And there seemed to be a general lack, and I think other experts will testify, is to the knowledge when it comes to this one issue is not getting to the judges. That issue is not being, you know, presented. Judges typically, because of a prohibition in law, didn't have access to seek, have to look at those issues, to even ask follow-up questions, was our understanding. So we've made a suggested law change to do that as well.
Judges have access to CCAP.
But not to look at all of those issues, anything related to domestic abuse, we were told.
Well, I can't, that's correct. A very broad statement, but thank you. Thank you.
And so what we would like to do, to speak to Justice Kelly's point, is
okay,
is to just make sure that we bring all of that information there. Many of the other data, you know, the 16 factors, we also weighed in. We have a bill to realign some of those factors. A lot of that other data is readily available, becomes evident. Domestic abuse is not reported, is very hard to identify, and to empower, even with a little more education, our GALs, to make that recommendation, to bring it to the attention of the judge, I think was really why this one issue rose to the top above some of the other things that came up with those factors.
Did you consider if the feeling isn't to require it on an ongoing basis to at least have an initial training so that everyone that becomes a GAL has had some training of domestic violence, even if just that initial piece? Did you consider the 3 hours or whatever it is initially, and then even if it's not an ongoing requirement, at least you know that at some point there's been a training to identify domestic violence?
I would say that Maureen, you can pipe in as well. The overall consensus of the committee was that GALs need a lot more training. Right. You know, and not just specific to this area, but this was an area that needs to be, I guess, some more light shed on it, because it has been kept kind of in the dark and not talked about, not looked at, or physical placement. You know, we know where the kids are going to go to school. We know the income of the parents. We know all of those things that impact those factors. You know, opiate abuse, a lot of that is very evident in a lot of cases. But domestic abuse is not. It has just been one of those things that's been hidden out there. And when we look at even reported cases, and I know others will testify to the actual details, I hope, today, the reported cases and that become even brought up at court are next to none. I mean, it's a small percentage. I think it was 4 or 5%. In some cases, even become aware, the judges become aware of those instances. That was disturbing to me as the chair of the committee, that judges are making placement decisions without all the facts, or at least even being aware that there may be suspicion of that, whether, you know, and we're talking domestic abuse, which leads into child abuse and other issues, to at least have a GAL with the training to possibly recognize those things and bring them to the attention of the judge so that he could then ask for expert witnesses, further testimony, you know, and make those decisions. I think that was really the important part. I would love, you know, for us to make a bigger appropriation to pay our GALs more, because I think they play such a critical role, you know, and this one mandate is not going to be a cure-all, but I think it's a really important fix right now.
Okay, thank you very much. The next person on my list is Gretchen Viney, Professor Viney.
Thank you, and thank you, Justice Kelly, for reading my memo. My name is Gretchen Viney. I thank you for having this open hearing. I'm a clinical professor at UW Law School. I have written frequently on the topic of guardian ad litem practice. I have 2 chapters in the guardian ad litem handbook. I've trained countless family law and children law and elder law guardians ad litem. I was a guardian ad litem myself for more than 30 years before going full-time to the law school. And I would love to have some of you ask the questions that you asked our prior speaker so that I could give my answers. I'm afraid with 7 minutes, I don't have time to address all of those. I do want to just say, please don't conflate domestic abuse with domestic violence as defined in the statutes. And also, please know that the world is full of false dichotomies, and the one I'm hearing the most today is all training or no training. This assumes that guardians ad litem are not taking advantage of the training offered to them, and I find that the false dichotomy is a little bit frightening here. I'm not going to reiterate what's in my memorandum. I wanted to bring some things to your attention that you might know. Sorry. We are all interested in competent and diligent guardians ad litem. I was on the committee, in fact, I think I was the co-chair of the committee that drafted SCR 35 and 36, for that matter, which is the elder law equivalent. The purpose of those rules was certainly not to make sure that guardians ad litem were well-trained in all aspects of their work. The purpose of that rule, Attorney Greg Herman and I, were to try to get rid of the people on the GAL lists that had no business being there. They were on the GAL appointment list because they had been on for a long time, and they really didn't understand joint custody, shared physical placement, or any of the other myriad issues. They were just guardians ad litem. And times were changing, so the court agreed that with a minimal of 6 credits of GAL training, a lot of those lawyers would not even be that interested. And it turns out they were not, and the lists were culled, and now we have people who actually express enough interest that they're going to get some specific training. I'm not here to diminish the importance of family violence in the family law system. But I think I might be the only guardian ad litem you're going to hear from today. So I want to make sure that you understand how many factors there are and how difficult it is for people to pick and choose what they need to know for particular cases. Breastfeeding, criminal activities, autism spectrum disorder, holistic medicine, religious differences, homeschooling, tattoos, driver's licenses, you name it, we look into it. And domestic violence is one of those things. I want to turn to the regulatory system, that this is the part that you have not heard before. How does the approval process work? BBE approves a workshop as GAL minor under 35.03 and posts that to its web page. So you go and you look and you see if a course was approved. BBE then approves all or a portion of that workshop as GAL-family guardian ad litem education under 35.03 sub 1M sub A. So as a separate posting, it says, this seminar was also approved for GAL family. Under the third proposal, we're going to have a third layer. And they're going to be asked to approve GAL minor family domestic violence. That means that the segment that they're approving as family violence must be a separate standalone session, just like EPR credits are. They're not going to drill down into an all-day workshop to see if family violence was covered. It's going to have to be a separate workshop that is labeled family violence. And remember that we do not have a meeting of the minds on what family violence is and how that relates to the traditional concept of domestic abuse. Let me tell you how this works on the ground. And I see I'm running out of time, so I'm freaking out a little. Okay.
Don't freak out. Just tell us what you need to say.
I wrote an article in 2013. It's in the Wisconsin Lawyer, called, cleverly, How to Be Eligible for Guardian Ad Litem Appointments. So if you look in February 2013, the Wisconsin Lawyer, you will find that article. So let's suppose a lawyer is asked to be a guardian ad litem in a divorce. The guardian ad litem first asks, am I eligible under SCR 35, GAL minor? To determine eligibility, the guardian ad litem says, okay, I'm in the middle of my current CLE reporting period. How many GAL minor credits do I have during this reporting period? Okay, let's say the answer is 3. Okay. The lawyer then asks, how many credits did I earn in my prior reporting period, my immediately prior reporting period? So you look at this reporting period and your completed immediately prior period. Let's say the answer is 6. So you have 9 credits. So that means you are eligible under SCR 35 because you need 6. That's for a Chapter 48 proceeding, but the credits are approved in general. Now, to determine eligibility for a 767 appointment, the lawyer must ask, how many of those approved credits were also approved as family law credits? So the lawyer needs 3 of those credits to be family law credits. So you look at the approval and you look to see if the BBE approved a workshop or part of a workshop for family law education. So let's say the lawyer has 2 family law credits. In that situation, the lawyer could be a GAL under Chapter 48, which is the Children's Code, but not in a 767 case. In order to be a GAL in a 767 case, which is the family code, you need 3 or more. Now, let's throw the proposed rule into the mix. Okay. The GAL must ask a series of additional questions. So first you figure out this reporting period and the last reporting period. Then you figure out whether 3 of those credits were family law credits. Now you have to ask how many of the family law education credits were approved as family violence credits. Whatever that answer is, hold it in your head. Because the next step is the lawyer must ask, is this my first appointment under the new rule? Whatever the effective date is, which is obviously not July 19th, but I hope it's not. Anyway, is this my first appointment under the new rule? If the answer is yes, this is my first case under the new rule, then you have to say, what number did I come up with in my first question? And if the answer is 3 or more, then the GAL is eligible to take a 767 case. If the answer is fewer than three family law violence credits, then the GAL is not eligible. What this means is that if a GAL wants to take an appointment under the new rule, then all 3 of the required family law education GAL credits must be on the exclusive topic of domestic violence. Now, the lawyer can take way more credits if they want to, but everyone keeps saying it's only 3 of 6. It's only 3 of 6. Well, it actually is 3 of 3 for that first go around. If it is not the lawyer's first case under the new rule, then the lawyer asks, what number did I come up with in subsection C, Roman numeral 1, whatever it is. If the answer is 1 or more, then the lawyer can continue to take guardian ad litem appointments in 767. If the answer is fewer than 1, a 0.5 might be possible, then the lawyer cannot serve as GAL in family court. This system is already hard enough for us on the ground to figure out. I had to write an article in a magazine for people to figure out how to make it work, and now we're going to add a super factor that we're going to have to engraft into that system, and I'm really saying on the ground, it's a lot harder to make work than it is in theory.
Can you think of a language change that would fit the purpose that they're proposing and not be as difficult as you've outlined?
Well, You could make family court GAL a completely separate Supreme Court rule, and then you could start piling on whatever you wanted to. But I can assure you that a lot of people would then opt out of that system, because family court GALs also, unless you are employed by the Legal Aid Society in Milwaukee, you have to have a real job when you're the GAL. GAL is what you do because you want to do it. So once you start piling on requirements, people will just say, no, thank you. But that is one way to do it. Then you wouldn't have all these layers of approval necessarily.
What about some kind of happy medium? Because I am thinking, like Justice Ziegler is thinking, that having GALs that have never had any domestic violence or family abuse, any kind of training on it at all, which is very possible, that you have GALs going into homes that have never taken any kind of class on it. How do we bridge that gap between making sure that doesn't happen and not making it so difficult for the credits? Is it not requiring three and doing one a year? Is it initially requiring it and then backing off and saying, okay, now we know you've had some training in this very important topic? I mean, how do we bridge that?
First of all, I am not sure it's correct that most GALs have had no training. Most GAL training seminars do include family violence. There is usually a 50-minute segment. I can't say always, not every single time, but there often is.
Well, can we ensure that then? I mean, is there something we can do to ensure that there is what you're saying? I'm not saying most. I don't know enough about it. I'm just saying it's possible that someone never has the training.
The problem is, we all take the same training year after year after year. The State Bar puts on GAL training. We used to have Through the Eyes of a Child that was fabulous and wonderful.
I remember, yeah.
And it was done away with because the court could not find measurable results. It's hard to find measurable results when you've got GALs around, but so we got rid of that. So now what we have is the State Bar training or standalone trainings, but the big firms have their own trainings. But for those of us who are solo and smalls, it's usually the State Bar or a standalone group. And people have to sign up and pay to take them. And we're already not paying GALs much, and we're requiring them to sign up and take a certain number of their credits as family law credits. And they still have to take real estate and whatever other things they're doing.
What if we had the lawyers fill out a certification to the court when they're seeking to be a guardian ad litem that they have received X amount of hours in training, and then they outline what that is? I'm just looking at Commissioner Bomrad's letter to the court, and she outlines three outstanding publications that would be useful for training. I mean, why do we have to have it specific to... I'm hearing your concerns, and they're valid. On the other hand, I'm hearing the concerns that this training would be particularly good for guardians ad litem to have. So why couldn't that person who wants to be a GAL in that kind of case certify what it is they've received as training to the court, and the court then decide whether or not they qualify for appointment?
Well, currently, if a lawyer accepts appointment as a guardian ad litem, the lawyer is holding out to the appointing court that the guardian ad litem is qualified under SCR 35 or 36.
I understand.
Family.
I hear your concern.
We don't have any certification requirements, and indeed, so many of our GALs have a lot of training in domestic violence. And to require them to go back to the same training year after year, because I assure you, I've been to many year after year, and they're essentially the same, is not really helpful when what we really should be looking at is autism spectrum disorder and how it affects families, or the opioid addiction crisis, or the meth crisis, or child development. There is absolutely no requirement that GALs have training in child development. These are the factors that the court inserted into SCR 35 for family law education were topics that BBE was having trouble approving as GAL education. And so the court listed out topics that the BBE could approve as GAL education, and it now does. And those include domestic violence, child development, and that sort of thing.
Okay, Attorney Viney. Here we go.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for being here. It's wonderful to see you. Now, I want to hear you say something other than no.
Okay.
Thank you, Anne.
Okay.
We were trying for the best question.
Yes. Yes, Justice Rogensack, the guardian ad litem cannot be the evidence. So when you talk about going into the home and talking to the kids, no, let me, please.
I'll let you finish, Gretchen, but you have to answer my question.
I will. I swear that I will. The guardian ad litem is asked over and over again by the legislature and by the courts to be the evidence, to present. We don't present ourselves as evidence. We do an investigation. We are trial advocates for the best interests of the child. We don't go into the court and talk to the children and tell the judge what the children said. We don't go into the home and say the kitchen was dirty and tell the judge the kitchen was dirty. We are not the evidence. What we do is we find a witness. We go into the court, into the house. The house is dirty. We subpoena the neighbor who will come in and testify, the house is dirty. So when you start mixing up what the GAL is going to tell the judge and what the judge is going to decide, we need to be really careful. And it is a recipe for malpractice for us to be expected to report to the court on anything outside the normal evidentiary gathering system.
It is a recipe for, I won't engage in hyperbole, it is a recipe for lots of problems if we don't have someone who's there marshaling the evidence.
Right, exactly.
I've genuflected at the altar of Gretchen Viney for years with regard to this guardian ad litem, but I happen issues. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking you.
Yep, what do I say yes to?
What do you say yes to? Because no, to me, just standing up and saying no, which you've done so far, my friend, isn't acceptable. I mean, it doesn't give me, it's acceptable, you can do it anything you want.
Thank you.
But I want more from you. I want you to say how this proposal can be modified in some way that doesn't... would be appropriate, that doesn't cause the kind of doom, despair, and agony that you're envisioning, right? So that's what I need from you, because to say no really gives me very little.
Okay, so you will not convince me to say yes to making a blanket requirement that all GALs have a specific training in domestic abuse writ large. I'm not going to say
okay.
Yes to that.
How about
but
writ,
I will,
writ initially and not the continuing one out of six?
What,
give me something.
I'm trying to. What I would
okay.
What I would envision is changing the number of family court credits, making that a higher number. And so if you wanted to be a GAL in a Chapter 767 case, your credits couldn't just be GAL minor general. They had to be more family court, and let the GALs, the professional lawyers, the lawyers here, decide, gosh, do I need more training in this area or this area or this area? Because some of our GALs do not need more training in domestic violence. They were social workers. They were nurses. They were whatever. They need more training in some other area, and let them decide.
I don't. Okay.
But
you've done your best, I guess.
What about the ability then to prove that you've had it? I mean, what I'm having no proof that they've had any domestic violence training is concerning. And while they may all have had it, and this may be the one person or the five people or the 10 people, it's still concerning. So what about an ability to either take these credits under, you know, the one time to get certified, or if you're coming from a social work background or you're coming from something else, to at least provide the evidence of the training that you've had, that something else could meet the definition of it. I mean, something like that.
The court, you have administration over all of your circuit courts. So I suppose you could direct your circuit courts to not appoint a guardian ad litem who cannot show to the satisfaction of the appointing court that the guardian ad litem has the necessary background in whatever areas you think are most important.
Except that makes it very much a burden on circuit courts in the case to case, and you might get certified by one court and not by another, and that's not helpful to the GALs either.
You could make a central registry of guardians ad litem. A lot of people would like that. They would like to know who is authorized to be a guardian ad litem in this state, and you could make a central registry. And once you have that bureaucracy going, you could make whatever requirements you wanted to. That would play into the legislature's desire to increase the resources for guardians ad litem. What we could really use would be expert witnesses. That's what we could really use, are expert witnesses who could come in and tell the court about the effect of. But remember, many, many of our cases do not involve domestic violence. Many do not. They involve other things. We could use resources. What I'm worried about is taking resources away from the lawyers who are trying to do this work and not giving them, you know, not giving them the resources that we actually do need, which are experts, expertise.
But those costs are all usually passed on to the litigants, and it's already very expensive.
Right. Exactly.
So,
it's,
I mean, a lot of people can't afford to get
that's why a central,
or can't afford to. It's very expensive.
A centrally funded office, because the counties cannot afford it. The other thing I just wanted to point out is family court, the state is involved because the parents cannot agree on custody and placement. It's not a CHIPS case. The state is not intervening because of abuse of the child. It's you and me arguing over our kids. And so when we pour resources into family court, we have to understand what we're doing. We're pouring resources into private families to make them or cause them or order them to come to an agreement about custody and placement of their children. There's no treatment order. There's no conditions for return. There's no trajectory. It's not a CHIPS case. It's not an intervention like that. It's a one-time, what is the placement schedule going to be, and what is the custody arrangement going to be? And so we need to be really careful when we talk about pouring resources into private families who are not able to manage their children. It's a state intervention that we need to be careful of, I believe.
Well, that was an interesting policy.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Did I answer your question?
No. I'm going to try to move the next speakers along a little bit more quickly. So if someone has already spoken has been singing the same song you would like to sing, certainly get up here and talk with us. But I'm going to really kind of push on the 7 minutes. Otherwise, we are not going to get through. We've been here more than an hour, and we have a lot of people that signed up to speak. So the next person on my list is Corey Linden.
Good morning, Chief Justice and other justices. My name is Corey Lundeen. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Legal Action of Wisconsin. We provide free representation to low-income individuals throughout southern Wisconsin. There's another legal aid law firm, Wisconsin Judicare, that practices in the northern half. Our family law attorneys at Legal Action work in our largest counties, Milwaukee and Dane. We also work in some of our smaller counties, Marquette, Crawford, Greenlake, Iowa counties, where there may only be one judge and a part-time family court commissioner. Our firm places a priority on representing family law litigants in cases involving family violence, domestic abuse, child abuse, and elder abuse. And unfortunately, the cost to obtain representation in family court is out of reach for many, if not most, litigants. There are lots of people who fall into the category of making too much money that they don't qualify for representation through my firm, but they don't make enough money to be able to go out and hire a private attorney. Unlike most developed countries, the U.S. provides no right to counsel in vital civil cases, such as family court. The state of Wisconsin provides no direct state funding for civil legal aid. As a result, resources for firms like mine and Wisconsin Judicare are very limited. I mention these facts because oftentimes the only attorney in family court, other than the judge, and other than an attorney from the child support agency, is often the guardian ad litem. As many people have mentioned, the guardian ad litem plays a unique role, a role that sometimes courts, sometimes litigants, and sometimes even guardian ad litems don't understand. I cringe every time I'm in court and I hear a guardian ad litem refer to the minor children in the case as their wards, as if they are a guardian of the person rather than as a guardian representing the best interests of the minor children. Guardian ad litems, first and foremost, must be good attorneys. If I had my way, I think there would be a lot more requirements in the SCR for attorneys to be guardian ad litem. Right now, the proposed rule provides a very modest suggestion or requirement for attorneys who are seeking to be appointed guardian ad litem in family court. As a comparison, to be appointed a guardian ad litem in juvenile court, we require 30 hours of training for Chapter 48, Chapter 938 cases. There's only 6 hours required for family court actions. I'm here to support the rule petition because I do think it places a very modest requirement on attorneys to spend 3 hours every 2 years on this specific issue. This month is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I raised that one of my colleagues at Legal Action and the president of the state bar, Jill Kastner, just wrote an article for this month's Wisconsin Lawyer and where she talked about some of the myths that are out there about domestic violence. Myths that domestic abuse is just a poor woman's problem, or it's only committed by angry male losers, or finally that victims should just leave and solve their problems. Those sort of myths are persistent in our family courts. They are persistent among guardians ad litem. And while there are 16 factors that guardian ad litems and courts have to consider when making recommendations from the guardian ad litem's perspective, when making the decisions from the circuit court judge's perspective, there's only one duty of the guardian ad litem that is required that they shall investigate and shall report to the court. And that is whether or not either parent has engaged in interspousal battery or domestic abuse. And those are very narrowly defined. Justice Kelly, to your point about why shouldn't the rule be more tailored to that specific requirement, I think it is important that it is broad because there are lots of situations where there is something that would be domestic abuse under a very broad definition of that word, but would not meet the statutory requirements. I think the training is broad so that should be broad so that guardian ad litems can know what does and what does not meet those requirements, because those specific requirements trigger presumptions for the court. Presumptions that change the presumption of joint legal custody to sole legal custody.
But if the training is broader than what the statute defines as domestic abuse, how is that going to be helpful to the court, which is limited to considering the factors contained in the statute?
I would argue that the broad definition of domestic abuse would be something that the court should consider.
Where do you get that broad definition from?
It's something that it is in the best interest factors. Those specific definitions are only there to trigger the legal presumptions changing. There can be plenty of situations where the court would consider something that doesn't meet those specific definitions, but would consider what happened as part of its broader best interest factors trigger those presumptions.
If it's all domestic abuse, why isn't the definition in the statute changed? Why do we have that definition then, if the actual concept that you want the court to consider is broader than what the statute says? What's the point of the definition?
The point of the definition is so that courts can make the decision about whether or not those statutory presumptions are triggered or not.
Right. That's the court's job.
And the point of having a broader training is for guardian ad litem to understand what are the factors that trigger those presumptions and what are cases that don't trigger those presumptions. My concern would be we have a training that is required only on those very specific statutory factors. We may end up in a situation where I've seen in some family courts where we have some family courts that take the perspective that they don't necessarily look at those specific definitions and they say, well, somebody has a restraining order. Case closed, sole legal custody to the person who has the restraining order. That's not what the statute says. I don't think the court should be making those calls. But I don't want to get us into a situation where guardian ad litems are so focused on only those specific statutory factors that they don't understand the difference between those factors and what may not be those factors. This is the only statute that places these responsibilities on the guardian ad litem. The legislature has placed
I want to make sure I understand your comment. So the training on domestic abuse should be broader. So the domestic abuse guidebook has a broader definition of what constitutes domestic abuse than the statute does.
Correct.
And you say that's necessary so that the GAO can understand the difference between what the statute says domestic abuse is and what the guidebook says domestic abuse is.
Correct. What is and what is not domestic abuse, which triggers the statutory presumption regarding custody and placement.
So the guidebook, when the guidebook defines domestic abuse more broadly than the statute, are you saying that it's doing that for the purpose of saying this is not domestic abuse within the meaning of the statute?
No. The definitions are in there, and they're in there only to trigger those legal presumptions. There are plenty of situations where there is something that meets that broader definition of domestic abuse that the guardian ad litem and the court will consider.
Right, but isn't this all going to be very confusing for a GAL to come in and say, okay, according to the guidebook, to recognize domestic abuse as something that is a universe this big, but then goes to the court and has to convey somehow, I understand that the statutory definition of domestic abuse is this big. And so now how is that training going to be helpful to the GAL in presenting information that's actually helpful to the court in applying the statutory factors?
Because I think what would be important for the guardian ad litem to do is to give a recommendation to the court of whether those legal presumptions change as a result of their investigation. Because that's essentially what the guardian ad litem, I think, should be doing. I completely agree with the previous speakers and with the Chief Justice about the role of the guardian ad litem. They're not there to come in and say, here's what I saw, and be a witness in the case. I think what the guardian ad litem should be doing is making a recommendation to the court of, is this a case where we have facts that trigger the presumption from joint legal custody to sole legal custody.
Right, but if the GAL is trained that a domestic abuse is this broad universe, isn't the GAL going to bring that perspective to the court and say, here's what the evidence is and I saw, and therefore that adds up to domestic abuse?
I think the guardian ad litem should be doing exactly that, and here's why. Here's the difference of the guardian ad litem doing that versus there's two scenarios. The guardian ad litem does an investigation. They are making recommendations to the court, and they could make recommendations that say, I think there was something that happened which is under this broad definition of domestic abuse, but it wasn't a serious or pattern of incidents that meets the specific statutory definition. So we're talking about a case which the legal presumption is joint legal custody, and the guardian ad litem may be making a recommendation that the court should follow that legal presumption of joint legal custody, as opposed to a situation where the guardian ad litem is saying the facts do fall under that the statutory definition. Therefore, we're looking at a different legal presumption for the court to consider. Because there are plenty of scenarios where there is something that falls under that broader definition of domestic abuse, which the guardian ad litem should be considering in their recommendations, and which the court should be considering in their judgment, but that don't trigger the change in presumptions from joint legal custody to sole legal custody, or the presumptions with physical placement regarding the safety of the children and of the domestic abuse survivor. So I do think the guardian ad litem should be broadly trained so that they can understand that difference and make a recommendation to the court based on their training.
Good. Thank you very much.
My time is up. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. The next person on my list is Kay Johnson.
Good morning. And if it would please the court, my name is Kay Johnson. I'm a mother with a lot of lived experience in family court. In fact, my children and I are casualties of the high-conflict family court in which we're all talking about, because it is in the high-conflict scenario that the GAL is appointed. And in my case, and what I have learned over the years of working with dozens of other families just like me, that the GAL fails to meet their responsibilities as outlined in the statutes. And I think that that's been alluded to, that there is really so much in the statutes that somebody is going to know, that someone needs to know in order to investigate all of these issues. And there's been such an explosion of information in the past 5 or 10 years on childhood trauma, that, and of which domestic violence is just a part, that it really makes you wonder if any attorney can really fill that role. And my case ended 6 years later when the criminal court judge said to my ex-husband at sentencing, and that is, God gave you two beautiful children and you screwed them up. And that was the end. And it was 4.5 years alongside of the guardian ad litem that he was screwing. He didn't investigate the domestic violence. He didn't investigate my husband's personality disorder. He didn't investigate all of the 408 days of interference while we were in family court that I didn't get to see my kids, because my ex-husband would hide them and nobody would stop them. Nobody would stop him. And my children could have been spared the mental and physical impairments that they now have as young adults. And as predicted by the science of childhood trauma, had that guardian ad litem had a clue about what was going on in our dysfunctional family, and we are dysfunctional, those of us in high-conflict family court, make no mistake about it. We don't just show up and don't get along. This is when we end up in a high-conflict family situation, there is some serious dysfunction in that family. And we can't just get along, and it doesn't just take two or all the other misunderstandings that happen in family court. But the stakes are just so very high. If guardian litems are going to be successful in this role, they have to understand, I mean, this is the most powerful role in the family court system. I know you can talk about how GALs aren't supposed to be the ones, it's the judge that makes the decision, but I will tell you, when the rubber hits the road and the judge is under a time crunch, and we have been in court for 4.5 frickin' years and we have no resolution, and our kids are being so traumatized that they are already depressed and anxious in third grade, Somebody's got to bite the bullet and bring that information to the judge. And that is not what happens in many, many cases that I've worked
with. Were you in Wisconsin family courts?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do. I do run I work with a national organization, but I work most. And it just begs the question to me, as why is it that attorneys have to be guardian ad litems? And not that I don't appreciate that they need more training, but they need, in order to handle these complex cases that are in high conflict, it seems to me that there are other professions that bring to the table the type of credentials that you're trying to teach an attorney. as continuing education. I worked for 25 years in the technical college system, and I was in charge of teaching and learning. And I will tell you that one CLE is one-tenth of one credit of instruction. And so you're saying that a CLE or three CLEs, 3 hours of instruction is enough to understand domestic violence or to understand childhood trauma or on top of being a lawyer? One-eighth or one-tenth of one credit is a conversation. It's not a credential. It's not a certification. It's not a qualification. It's a conversation. And if my point is, you cannot teach attorneys who have gone through, you know, umpteen years in law. It is not continuing education unless it pertains to their law. If it's continuing education in real estate, fine. If it's continuing education in taxes, they already know that. But these are psychologists. I hear everyone saying this is so complicated. We need to have expert witnesses, and I guess I'm just totally agreeing with that. But I'm also saying that, and they're saying there's a shortage because they don't want to do all this extra work, and it's not worth their while because they're not paid enough. There are plenty of qualified applicants to be GALs, people like and counselors, and if it was opened up, if you didn't have to be, I don't understand why you have to be a lawyer to understand family, to understand those dynamics, to understand, to be able to read people and to care about kids. And that's what I think a GAL should do. And I've been in cases where a family hasn't even seen the judge for a year and a half while the GAL made all of the placement and schedules. I mean, I was the expert witness in that case, and I just was going, where's the judge?
Well, that's a good question. I'm wondering the same thing
myself. You want the case number? I mean, I can give you lots of case numbers. I'm just trying to be realistic here, and I'm listening to all of this complicated law stuff, and I'm just trying to bring it down to that this is for our kids. This is the future of our kids. This affects them. When we're in court fighting, however you want to view that, there's got to be some resolution. And high conflict cases don't have any resolution. I read the article that was written about why GALs, how they get to be GALs. And that article that was written in 2013 and just reviewed, and the second line of that article states, and this is in the Wisconsin, from the Wisconsin Bar Association, and I quote, serving as a court-appointed GAL or appointed guardian ad litem is one way for a new lawyer to gain paid legal experience. I am just shocked. My family is not going to be put at risk while somebody, a new lawyer, gets some paid legal experience. That's not what that's all about. I don't, to bring this to a conclusion, I just have to be lawyers. We're paying for two of them already, and now we've got a third one. You can teach with CLEs. You could teach a social worker or a counselor or a teacher or someone who has 4 to 6 to 8 years of family dynamics under their belt. You can teach them how the process in the courtroom goes. You can do that with CLEs. I don't think you can do it the other way around.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next person on my list is Amy Behrens.
Hello, Your Honors, and thank you for having me here today. I stand before you today on behalf of victims of domestic abuse and as a survivor of abuse that included psychological, emotional, and financial control. You may have noticed that I did not say physical abuse, and that's because my marriage did not include physical abuse. I also stand before you today because the current petition in front of you appears to only contain language that requires continuing legal education for guardian ad litems to only understand family violence in the context of the use of force. I offer my testimony today as evidence on the need for strengthening the understanding of abuse in terms of power and control in the hopes of preserving the emotional well-being of victims and protecting the lives of children. And today, I also respectfully ask that you refer this world petition to another entity for further review and recommendation. At a minimum, I would ask that it be amended to 1, change the term family violence to dynamics and impact of domestic abuse and domestic violence in the context of pre- and post-separation. 2, include mandatory training on implicit bias. It is prevalent out there, and I have evidence to prove so. Make available to the public proof of completed CLEs upon request. And most importantly, there needs to be some oversight here because it's happening, and I have people reaching out to me after my story was published on the USA Today and about 7 USA Todays across the state of Wisconsin in July. Perhaps some of you have read the article. I do have it here if I could show it. And
if you give us the site, I think that's probably will serve your purposes best because then the court can pull it up.
I do know it's on the Wausau Daily Herald.
Okay, thank you.
And the title comes from a quote from the guardian ad litem in my case, advocating without a rule book. As he states, there is no rule book. And that was clearly evident in what had happened. As I had mentioned, the psychological, the financial, the emotional abuse that the children and I endured was ignored for many years in a 5-year divorce.
Can you tell me more than that? You said Wausau Daily Herald, but what's the date on it? That would help me find it.
It was on the website on July 9th.
Thank you very much.
That's and perfect. Published in the paper on July 4th on a Sunday.
Okay.
So my marriage, it wasn't physically abusive, but as I tried to leave, knowing the emotional, the financial, and all the kind of control that was there, something wasn't right. I didn't actually learn about domestic abuse until I ended up at a women's shelter. But at that point, I was already labeled as an abuser myself. He has people in law enforcement that he knows. He's from that area. I'm not. There was more power and control on his side than mine. And I reached out for help, and I knew his habits and his attitude towards women and children. So, after years of begging the police to look into the stalking behaviors, which is very terrorizing and to this day still haunts me because I don't know if he stopped. He knew where I was. He knew what I was doing. He even knew sometimes what I was saying. And at first I didn't know how it was happening until I learned about the devices that can be downloaded on your phone. Cameras turned on, apps turned on. But then I was labeled as crazy and nobody would believe me. So back in 2015, and this 5-year divorce was still dragging on through the court system, and I found out that my children were not being dropped off in time or at all during the exchange nights, and I started worrying what's going on. I find out that the father joined a ski team, part of the reason our divorce dissolved in the first place. He was putting needs before the children and I, and I said, if you want to do that, that's fine. Just let me know. I'll take the kids. You can do that. And he just laughed at me and said, you can't tell me what to do anymore. And I said, I'm not telling. What he didn't understand is I wasn't trying to tell him what to do. I was trying to give him his flexibility and stop what I was doing. Whatever it was, I said, I'll take the kids. And he laughed at me. My lawyer suggested I go to CPS when I found out he was leaving the children next to a lake alone without any supervision. And I did what my lawyer suggested. And they launched an investigation but closed the investigation saying I was just doing this to gain custody in a divorce case. A very, very unfortunate assessment on their part. I had evidence that they didn't watch, and they said they did, but they closed the investigation. 11 months later, I got the worst phone call of my life when I heard Jackson was hit and run over by a truck. And he was at the same place that I said it was going to happen. And now you think that all these people are going to come back to you and say, you were right. But it doesn't happen like that for victims. You get re-victimized. And the GAL in our case did that. After our first one, Sarah Sancourt, was shot and murdered on March 22nd, 2017. I'm sure all of you know about Sarah Court. And her story and why that murder happened was very similar to my own. In fact, my professor from college, who taught me journalism, sent the story to me and said, Amy, I can't believe how close your story and the woman who was the target in the situation matched yours. You were labeled the abuser. You weren't believed. It escalated. And now four people were shot and killed on a day when those red flags were there and they're being ignored. So now I try to work and protect and bring those red flags forward to show and protect hope in the hopes that those things don't happen, because the stalking is a sign that abuse is going to escalate, but it's ignored. There are other signs as well. When the GAL got involved after Sarah passed away, I tried to object to it because I knew of the conflict of interest that was there. My ex and him used to work at the ski hill as ski patrol together, and it wasn't accepted, and that's when all the additional trauma started happening. I was labeled somehow as crazy. I was labeled hysterical in the hospital as I watched my son's chest being pushed up and down by a machine, mechanically. That is a memory that intrudes my thoughts every day. I suffer from diagnosed PTSD, and that was used against me.
Thank you. I can see that you have had a very, very difficult time, and I'm sorry that our courts played a role in that for you. So thank you for having the courage to come here and to tell us all about it. We do appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, and I do want to mention, too, that my children were given back to him, and my daughter then went on to make 3 suicide attempts at his house.
Okay.
Each time, it was covered up, and I could not get the help. The GAL finally put in his report that he never mentioned the child neglect substantiation. He never mentioned our daughter's 3 suicide attempts and her wanting to come live with us or me. And in the end, he said that if I went to trial with this, that he would be presenting evidence that we didn't know anything about that would prove to the judge that the kids should be with the father and not me. That scared me, and I was never able to take my side to there. I was left with all the medical bills because I was forced to settle out of court based on his words. So I think there needs to be additional oversight. Since my story aired, I've had so many people reach out to me. And another problem I think that is implicit in our society is the implicit bias. I have women who have told me about other GALs in our town writing on their Facebook post that women are like the town bicycle. Everybody's ridden them. And these are the people being in charge of deciding where children are supposed to be placed.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
I'm sure that you have a lot more that you could tell us about your experiences, and I do appreciate your coming here. But we have to move on to the next speaker.
Thank you for having me, and yeah. I do ask again that the wording be changed and more protections put in place.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for coming.
Yes.
Okay, our next speaker is Jennifer Mostyn.
Thank you, Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court. I will have a lot to say, but I will go as quick as I possibly can to keep things moving along. excuse me. I am a survivor of domestic violence. I want to give you a little oversight of my family court case that I went through in Waukesha County with a guardian ad litem and social worker. I have 4 wonderful children. My 4th child was with this abusive man, my ex-husband. For 6 years, I documented all the abuse that I was enduring. I tracked everything to pictures of all the bruises, everything like that. All of that evidence was ultimately presented to my guardian ad litem and social worker. Spent hours with them going through it. And excuse some of the language, but I just want to walk through some of the information that the guardian ad litem was aware of. Some things that I took out of my documentation. And mind you, all of this was said or happened in front of 4 children. Let's see, he said he wanted to break my jaw when he punches me, threatened to choke me to death, wish I would get in an accident and die, said constantly that anyone upset him, he would kill everyone that night, threatened to bash my head in with a baseball bat, wanted to throw me through a wall. He would constantly put a gun out in sight and say that me and the kids were going to die. He would swerve into oncoming traffic with our baby in the car, saying he wanted to kill me and our son. He told me he wanted to wrap his hands around my neck, choke me until I was laying on the ground. He said he wanted to bash me with a frying pan. He would spit in my face. He would hold toy guns to my head, clicks, and say he would do it if he could get away with it. He'd get mad and throw things and break things around the house if he thought I was paying too much attention to the kids and not him. One time when I was holding the baby and I was begging him to leave, he broke my arm in three places, kicked me in the stomach so hard I flew across the room, landing on my wrist and broke it. When I was 5 months pregnant, he threw me down a flight of stairs after I tried to leave the house with the children after he threw something at me. He would teach my sons that there's nothing wrong with hitting a woman if the woman deserves it and it should be legal. He would tell me time and time and time and time again that if I ever left him, he would kill me and he would kill our son. If I tried to leave the house, he'd tell the kids that I don't love them and I don't care about them until they started to cry. I'll keep moving on. Another time he put his fist under my chin, lifted me up off the ground, threw me across the room into a chair, leaving my entire arm covered in bruises. Told me he wanted to stab me in the throat and watch me bleed to death. Held me down by my hair on my bed and told me if I didn't get my IUD taken out so he could get me pregnant again, he would rip it out himself. And I won't even go over all the names he would call me in front of his kids. After years of enduring this and my children enduring this, I finally got the courage to leave a few weeks after he finally strangled me, and I knew I would eventually die. Right away, I met with an amazing DA and detective in Waukesha County. I handed over my 24 pages of documentation. The detective spent a few months investigating and eventually charged him with 9 felonies, including strangulation, stalking, and battery. I filed for divorce and naively trusted that family court would take care of my son. But as I said, I spent hours and hours with this guardian ad litem and social worker, and I will never, ever forget the words that they said to me. One is, I believe he abused you in some form, but I don't think he abused your son. And also, he's a good father because he never touched your son. They did not understand the ramifications of what the children had seen. My son would cling to me and bury his head in my chest when his father was in a fit of rage with me. He would cling to me. I was holding him when his father broke my arm, clung to me on the bathroom floor while I was crying while his father stood over me screaming at me. His father would swear and yell at me as I was breastfeeding him. To this day, my son is visibly shaken every time he thinks I'm upset. I think that, I don't know if the guardian ad litem just didn't have the training or the social worker to understand domestic violence. Most abusive men are very charming, which is how my ex-husband got me. They didn't understand how abusive men attract women. They're not educated enough to see through it. They did not understand power and control. Not one time did the guardian ad litem or the social worker reach out to the DA or the detective on the case to talk to them. It is my understanding that a DA is not going to bring charges against someone if they do not feel that that this person is guilty. Not once did they reach out to the DA detective. It was the day we had court that a final recommendation of placement, I was given 1.5 hours notice from the guardian ad litem who emailed me her recommendation to give my abuser 50-50 placement unsupervised. 1.5 hours. I can't even explain what that did to me. It actually forced me to feel like I had to go back to him. And that's what I really feel like. These guardian ad litems are not looking out for the children, that they're forcing women to stay in abusive relationships because there's no protection for the son. Even though there was a restraining order, it was ordered I had to hand my son over to him in person, and then it turned into I had to hand him over in an unmanned police station at Delafield. He was allowed to pick my son up at his daycare and school, which obviously this man's charged with 9 felonies, and the school was scared and had to have police come in and talk to the teachers about what to watch out for. This guardian ad litem was putting not only my son and my other children in danger, but she was putting an entire school in danger as well. In essence of time here again, during sentencing in the criminal case, during this, when the guardian ad litem would say I had to hand him off or I had to do this, I had to keep going back to my district attorney and having to go back into criminal court and have that judge protect me from family court and say, nope, there's a restraining order, you can't do this. During the sentencing in the criminal case, there was a full week trial, and the judge there ultimately saved my son by sentencing his father to 8.5 years prison, and then in order to save my son from going back into family court, because if he would have gotten out after only 5 years, he would have taken me back to family court. I know family court would have handed my son over to this man again. That judge, again, saved me, said he's not allowed to contact my son for 10 years after he's out of prison, so we have 18.5 years protection, because the judge said he recognized that family court would not give me that protection.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your experience with us. I know it takes a lot of courage to talk about something that's obviously been so terrifying and has gone on for such a long time and has affected you as well as your children. So thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for your time today.
Megan Paulson.
Good morning, Honorable Justices. My name is Megan Paulson, and I want to thank you so very much for hearing me speak today on this important issue. I'm here to present my support for the mandatory domestic violence training for guardian ad litems based upon my own personal experience with domestic abuse and based upon my experience with the guardian ad litem subsequent custody recommendation for my children. I divorced my abusive husband after he nearly killed me while we were living overseas. During his most brutal attack, my 10-year-old son witnessed part of it. All three of my children saw my injuries and were very aware that our family was splitting up because of the abuse. Shortly after the attack overseas, my three children and I moved back to Wisconsin. And as is typical of abusers, my abuser sought to extend his domination and control of me and moved a mere 3 blocks away from where my kids and I settled. He regularly sought opportunities to physically intimidate me and demonstrate that he would continue to make himself a threatening presence in my life. I was able to get a restraining order. My most important challenge was fighting for the physical placement and legal custody of my children. I breathed a sigh of relief when I read the law in place, Act 130, which favors physical placement and legal custody to a victim of domestic violence. My kids would be safe, and I would not be forced to co-parent with the man who put his family's well-being in jeopardy. Sadly, I learned that Act 130 is rarely applied in domestic violence family court cases. I also learned that a guardian ad litem would recommend how our family would operate over the next 14 years until my youngest daughter turned 18. Despite not having any domestic violence training or expertise, this person would be making a final recommendation. My abuser pled guilty to a federal assault charge and admitted to being abusive for 13 years. However, the guardian ad litem in our case viewed my abuser's admission as an act of candor, noting how impressed she was by his honesty and remorse. Without training in the behavioral patterns of domestic abusers, the guardian ad litem failed to recognize my abuser's sincerity as a classic form of manipulation. Even after interviewing friends and family members who saw signs and witnessed abuse towards me and my children, the guardian ad litem listened more carefully to the supervisor who had attended my ex-husband's visits with the kids and reported how engaged he was with our children at the park, at restaurants, at bowling alleys. I tried to explain to the guardian ad litem that when watchful eyes are on an abuser, he's charismatic, he's empathetic, and he's overly engaged. After the supervised visits came back with glowing reviews, the guardian ad litem was also convinced that he too is a good dad and that he would follow an agreement set forth by the court. Then after very briefly meeting with each of my three children, the guardian ad litem did not recommend sole legal custody to me, and she recommended unsupervised placement. While our case concluded in the courts, the dynamics have not changed. The guardian ad litem's recommendation forces me to co-parent with my abuser. Her decision forces me to remain in contact with someone who almost killed me and continues to be a danger to me. It also forces me to remain in part trapped in the cycle that took so long to leave. But more egregiously, the guardian ad litem has forced my kids to live unsupervised with an abuser who is unmonitored. In domestic violence cases, the reform of an abuser and the safety of the children isn't assured simply because a custody decision is made or a divorce is final. It's imperative that subsequent monitoring is part of a guardian ad litem's recommendation. Guardian ad litems wield a significant power in determining custody. Without requiring them to undergo mandatory domestic violence training, their custody decisions are apt to be more based on empirical evidence and gut instinct rather than informed by research-based criteria applicable to domestic violence cases. The cost and time of the proposed training requirement is minimal when it's weighed against leaving the best interests of children to chance. Courts are relying on a guardian ad litem to be an expert, and therefore we must equip them with the expertise to make well-informed decisions when dealing with domestic violence. Thank you very much for listening and for implementing this very necessary change.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming and sharing your story with us. It's very important. Jenna Gormal.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rogan-Sack and Justices of the Supreme Court. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today regarding the proposed CLE change to require guardians ad litem to attend a course on domestic violence and the impact of family violence as part of their initial and ongoing legal education. Before I begin, I would also like to thank Representative Brooks, Senator Taylor, and the rest of the Legislative Study Committee on Child Placement and Support for their diligent work on the proposal. My name is Jenna Gormal, and I represent End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, the statewide membership organization representing local domestic violence, victim service providers, and the voice for survivors of domestic violence throughout the state. We support the petition and respectfully request that the court adopt the rule change. For nearly 40 years, the policy work of End Abuse has been grounded in the experience of survivors and the advocates who serve them. Throughout that period, survivors and advocates have consistently reported that one of the main challenges survivors face is navigating the complicated family law system to keep themselves and their children safe. Unfortunately, their experiences with the system have all too often resulted in horror stories that we hear on a daily basis, and some of which you've heard today. These stories motivated us to search for innovative solutions to help the family law system better serve survivors and their families. To have a more complete understanding of the outcomes of cases involving domestic abuse, End Abuse researched family law cases in which one parent had a prior criminal conviction for domestic abuse, a felony or a misdemeanor battery against the other parent. Since all examined cases involved a documented history of domestic abuse before the divorce filing, researchers expected to see evidence of the family law process accounting for domestic abuse in child custody and placement outcomes in most of the cases. However, The findings call into question the extent to which the family law system is appropriately identifying and responding to domestic abuse in accordance with the statutory protections for victims and their children. And there are a few findings that I'd like to highlight for you today. Although a criminal court had previously convicted one parent of domestic abuse against the other in all 361 cases reviewed, the family court made domestic violence findings in only 8% of cases. And I'll emphasise, these cases contain previous convictions of no less than battery, so 8% of cases. The majority of final orders in these cases, 80%, did not include any explicit provisions for the safety of the victim or children, despite statutory language directing courts to order provisions related to safety when it is found that domestic abuse has occurred in Wisconsin Statute 76741, sub 6. The court appointed a GAL in 37% of cases. However, despite the statutory obligation to report, most of the cases involving a GAL did not contain written GAL recommendations on custody or placement or references to domestic violence. When the GAL recommendation was known, the GAL recommended sole legal custody to the domestic abuse victim in less than half the cases, 48%, despite the statutory presumption against joint or legal custody to the abusive parent and despite Wisconsin Statute 767.41 sub 2. The results of this study provide the backdrop for our position on the need for requiring initial and ongoing training for GALs. The fact that the safety of the victim and child does not appear to factor into the majority of GAL recommendations or is detected at all, even when there is a criminal conviction of a domestic violence crime, is a troubling trend that must be addressed if we are ever to ensure that family law decisions are really in the best interest of the child. GALs who attend approved training on all forms of domestic violence and the impact of family violence are in a better position to bring to the court's attention evidence of abuse that parents or attorneys may be reluctant to introduce, use their investigation to determine the effects of exposure to domestic violence on children, and make sound recommendations that address any safety concerns of children and abused parents. Children who witness domestic abuse or are victims of emotional, physical, or sexual abuse are at higher risk for health problems as adults, including anxiety, depression, and substance abuse. Children growing up with an abusive parent experience feelings of conflict and anxiety and may not be forthcoming about the abuse they are witnessing or experiencing. And it is incumbent upon the GAL to recognize the abuse even when the child is not forthcoming. We must ensure that GALs are educated in the dynamics of domestic violence because their recommendations have a critical impact on the lives of victims and their children.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming in.
I have a couple of comments as well, specifically. I have a couple of things I'd like to add.
I thought you were concluded.
I had concluded, but then after listening today, I just wanted to add a couple more. Okay. Respect to Justice Kelly's comments regarding the statute and the language and releasing that to the guidebook. So the guidebook is not detached from the statutory language and legal analysis because there are two critical aspects of Wisconsin Statute 767.41 sub 2D that directly correspond to the discussion about coercive control which is contained within the guidebook. So first, in some cases, the statute directs the court to apply the presumption against sole or joint legal custody against the party who has used a pattern of coercive and abusive behaviour. So when the court finds that both parties engage in a pattern or serious incident of interspousal battery or domestic abuse, the guardian ad litem may be required to consider who is the primary physical aggressor in order to determine how the presumption against joint and sole custody should be applied. And explicitly, Wisconsin Statute 767.41 sub 2D2E requires that the court consider whether there is or has been a pattern of coercive and abusive behaviour when determining the primary physical aggressor. Therefore, investigation of coercive and controlling abuse can be essential to determining if and how the presumption against sole or joint legal custody should be applied. And second, because the definition of domestic abuse includes stalking, many cases of coercive and controlling abuse will meet the definition of domestic abuse, regardless of the level of physical abuse. So these cases are eligible for the application of the presumption against joint custody. Stalking, as defined in Wisconsin Statute 940.32, is incorporated into the definition of domestic abuse. Therefore, when one party has stalked another party, the presumption against sole or joint legal custody applied against the perpetrating party. And the elements of stalking strongly correspond to coercive controlling behaviour. Generally, stalking occurs when the stalker engages in a course of conduct that causes the victim to reasonably experience serious emotional distress or to fear bodily injury or death, and when the stalker knew or should have known that at least one of the stalking acts would cause the victim to experience this distress or fear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to let the other people have a chance to speak this morning, and thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you.
Testimony is very helpful.
Thank you.
Carrie Patzer.
Good morning, honorable judges. My name is Carrie Patzer, and thank you for listening to me speak today. Domestic violence incidences had been happening in my home for years, and I had wanted it to stop. I dreamed of my daughter and I being safe. There was an incident in my home that involved the police department. My now ex-husband was arrested for battery, assault, and disorderly conduct. He had pinned me against the wall with one arm, shoved behind my back, and one hand over my neck. I couldn't breathe except when I turned my neck all the way to one side. He was not charged with anything by the district attorney. The police officers never followed up the next day to check for injuries or bruises. And as we all know, they do not show up immediately. The GAL met with us once and met with him once. I didn't know how to prepare or what to expect. So I brought children's books, Kinetic Sand, and some of my daughter's favorite toys because I wanted the GAL to authentically engage with my daughter, who had just turned 3. We went into the GAL's office, and there was nothing child-friendly. We sat at some leather chairs and a hardwood table. She did not establish a connection in this meeting with my daughter. I just kept trying to get her to interact with my daughter, but she didn't. She asked me to leave the room. I felt like I was doing something wrong. It was all very rushed. The GAL gave off a strong impression she didn't feel this meeting was important. I have a background in childhood education, and I just couldn't understand how our GAL was making the most important decision about my daughter's life. And it struck me as odd and terrified me that she had no understanding of children or my daughter. My ex-husband and his attorney pushed for a psychological evaluation, an assessment of me. There were 3.5 days of tests, reading, writing, math, ink blot tests, so much more. To this day, I don't understand why I was forced to endure this after I had just experienced the most terrifying experience of my life. I went through this very intense interview process. I was the DV survivor, but I felt like I was a criminal being interrogated. The person doing the evaluation started interviewing me about my childhood. She pushed me to talk about the time that I had been sexually abused by a stranger, and it had occurred when I was 5 years old. I remember what her body posture looked like as she did this. She leaned in and was really intense. The experience was incredibly traumatizing, and I just kept thinking, what does this have to do with my ex-husband and or domestic abuse? After this evaluation, I almost lost my daughter to my ex-husband at the evaluator's and the guardian ad litem's decisions. The evaluator said that the abuse didn't really happen. My ex-husband came across as charismatic and credible to her. In one comment in the evaluation, he said, "What a loving family," meaning him, his daughter from another mom that I had raised for 7.5 years, and my daughter. The evaluator interacted with my 4-year-old. She was loud. She wouldn't get down on the level. My daughter's 4. And get down on her level. This also bothered me as a childhood educator. After the evaluation and the recommendation to take my daughter away and place her back into my abuser's hands, her father, we went back into marital mediation. My husband received final decision-making authority over custody issues. I was asked to give up my financial security by trading the equity in my home for time back with my daughter. He would say, I will give you another day if you give me more equity in the house. My GAL did not advocate in any way to explain how this can happen. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I can understand. It's difficult to tell us about all this.
And I just ask that I may respectfully submit this. It's my daughter.
That's fine. You can give it to the marshal. Sue Moen.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. My name is Sue Moen, and I work for Safe Harbor of Sheboygan as a legal advocate, non-attorney, which I often relate to people. Safe Harbor is an agency serving victims of domestic abuse and sexual assault. I work directly with victims of domestic violence and abuse as they seek assistance related to both criminal and civil court proceedings. Though there can be overlap, supporting victims through pending criminal cases is much different, of course, than supporting them through contested family court matters. I want to share with you information about a particular case in which the education of the guardian ad litem was put to the test. Identities of parties in this case, of course, are changed for purposes of confidentiality. Sadly, this case represents many similar cases with which I am familiar. Most of all, I hope that the education guardians ad litem receive will lead them to recommend remedies such as supervised visitation, and not for punitive purposes, but to make breathing space for children and families to begin to heal and to begin to overcome the awful effects of trauma. In the spring of 2017, I heard from a regular Safe Harbor client whose spouse had just filed for divorce. The petitioner spouse was repeatedly threatening our client to get full custody and placement of the children. Our client, the respondent, had been the primary caregiver of the kids in every facet of their lives. Only when the youngest was of preschool age was our client, mom, allowed to work outside of the home. Dad was the primary breadwinner and maintained control financially and through intimidation. He was rarely physically violent, but he occasionally knocked one of his children off of a chair or tripped them. Once, when mom had threatened to call 911, he grabbed her, mom, and put her in a chokehold in front of the children. As she struggled to free herself, she scratched his arm. He called 911, and officers arrested mom because she had inflicted an injury. in my advocacy work, objectivity can be important, but very challenging. The guardian ad litem in this instance dubbed this a high conflict divorce with toxic parties. Through that lens, the guardian ad litem may have been predisposed to dismiss a lot of the mother's concerns as to the children's well-being. Sometimes concerns are lumped under a label such as hysteria. Other words were used, but the guardian ad litem in this case characterized mom as overreactive and high-strung at best. After a four-hour guidebook training, I'm shifting gears, I'm sorry, that my agency sponsored shortly after the guidebook was published in 2017. After the presentation by Tess Moyer, who's the former Justice Director of End Abuse Wisconsin, this is a comment I overheard. A guardian ad litem stated, "Well, I'm still a bit suspicious when mom seeks a restraining order and then files for divorce." I hope that sets off alarms in your mind. There's no, and it's okay, you may or may not know this, but there's no more dangerous time for an abused spouse and her children than when she's preparing to leave the relationship. In spite of him having filed for divorce, divorce can just be another way of maintaining control. Post-decree control is very similar to prejudgment. At any rate, I want to tell you about one of the children whose lives was to be profoundly affected by the findings and recommendations of that of the GAL back to the divorce, pardon me. Recommendations of the GAL and the resulting orders of the court. Mitchell was about 4 years old when this divorce was filed. Mitchell is a child who has a medical condition that affects his ability to be nourished by food. For him, there are foods that are helpful and foods that are harmful. Children's Hospital in Milwaukee is the entity through which Mitchell's condition was identified and at which he has been frequently monitored and treated. Sometimes domestic abusers, of course, use their children as pawns to exert control over their spouses. Mitchell's father, during his times of placement, based on a temporary order, fed Mitchell foods that were harmful to him given his medical condition. This was neglectful at best, but it did correlate with Dad not needing mom to tell him what his kid needed. When Mitchell's mom received him back into her care, he had been ill while away. To be clear, Dad had been told of Mitchell's condition and knew that it was important to feed him certain foods. There were times when his condition, there were times when Mitchell's pediatrician recommended that food diaries be kept so that his disease could be better understood and his treatment refined. One parent kept food diaries and one did not. One parent fed Mitchell only the foods that could help his body. The other parent fed him primarily foods that were bad for his body. Mitchell was on a sickening roller coaster, 4 years old, because one of his parents disregarded his other parents pleading to please make sure he eats well and takes his medicine. Mitchell would come home to mom with all of the medication he had taken to Dad's house. Mitchell's pediatrician, Dr. T, and one of his regular nurses, Nurse Ben, received food diaries from mom. Dad never turned in food tracking in any form. Somehow Dad was given custodial impasse decision-making with regard to medical issues. One day, on a transition day from Dad's to mom's home, Mitchell stepped off of his preschool bus into mom's arms and began crying. Mom naturally asked him why he was so upset. Mitchell's first words were these, "Mama, are you going to jail?" The school bus driver was stopping the bus and put it in park, of course, and stepped off of the bus and told Mom he seemed so sad today. Connor and Hadley, Mitchell's older siblings, are not allowed to call their mom during their dad's placement times. This continues. Dad disregards Mom's requests on behalf of the kids. He disregards exchange times. He disregards diet, safety. He disparages Mom every single day. He does not keep deadlines and appointments that are critical for the kids' needs. Being a guardian ad litem means being, in part, a specialist at screening. I understand they're not an expert, they're not a psychologist, but there are school counselors, there are teachers, there are bus drivers, there are pediatricians, there are on and on and on people who play a role in children's lives who have information, who know that family. And if a guardian ad litem does not take the time to interview corroborating, you know, witnesses to this family's life, then what is presented or recommended to the court is woefully inadequate for the court to be able to make a wise decision about visitation and supervision.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming and for sharing one of the stories of one of your agency's clients.
Thank you.
Natalie Hayen. Is Natalie here? I have her on my list. Okay, she's maybe decided to not stay then. That completes the list of everyone that was given to me. Is there anybody here? And I'm going to let the presenter come back and say a couple things at the end. But is there anybody here who would like to speak who did not sign up with our marshal in advance? Okay, very good. Would you like to, Representative Brooks, do you want to come up and make a few comments?
So you want to go first?
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If it pleases the court. I think that the primary issue here is balancing the well-being of children and families and the benefit of getting the right outcomes in family court cases against the question of inconveniencing guardian ad litems in selecting a specific type of credit in their education. The arguments that I heard today for and against the petition, the primary argument that I heard was that this does not go far enough. We heard story after story after story where guardian ad litems did not understand the dynamics of domestic violence and did not provide the recommendation to the court that would have perhaps been a different recommendation and would have perhaps been a different outcome had the guardian ad litem had the education in domestic violence. I think that to address the Chief Justice's concerns, to address Justice Kelly's concerns, I don't think that this petition to require educational credits is going to solve all of the problems of the court, all of the problems of families going through these issues, but I do think that it is a start. I think that it's a step in the right direction, and I think that requiring this education is going to give the background and the education that guardian ad litems need to at least have a framework, to at least have some understanding of the issues that is absolutely critical for them to understand in order to make a recommendation to the court that is the right thing for the well-being of the children and the families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for hearing our presentation today. I'll go back to my opening comments, and that was that we had a very diverse committee. I think you heard some of the testimony here today that was very passionate. I don't want to discount that passion. I don't want to discount the life stories. But I do want to say, you know, this is a very important issue. I think you can hear through the life stories the ramifications of domestic abuse, you know, and home violence. And I think by enabling, and I trust this court to make the right decision. I understand the concerns of Attorney Viney. Is it Dr. Viney?
No.
Okay. Attorney Viney and the complications and the issues that you're dealt with. But I truly don't think you can discount the need for additional training, whether that's a certification, whether that's additional hours, whether it's one-time training. I'll defer to the court on that, but I can tell you based on the broad testimony that we heard over months, there's a dire need to address this issue. And I beg you to do that. We weighed a number of issues, and it always came back to one key thing, best interest of the child. Best interest of the child. And all of the issues that you heard today are systemic throughout all of the issues that you deal with and that I deal with as a legislator. So I think this is a key area we really need to address. So I just beg that you, you know, truly look at this issue and come up with some resolution, whatever that may be. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Very good. Well, thank you, and please thank the other members of your committee who were not here today.
Thank you. The court
very much appreciates the work that you did, the information you gathered, and the time that it took for you to put together a proposed rule petition for us.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
All right, we are going to adjourn now. The court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. Julie, can you join us at 1:30? We are adjourned.
Tammy, that picture belongs.